Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks a lot for listening today. A law just took effect in New Jersey, August 1st, that allows certain terminally ill patients in the state to choose the time and place of their deaths. The Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act permits adults diagnosed with 6 months or less to live to get a prescription for a life-ending medication. Now, 9 states, including the District of Columbia, already allow doctors to prescribe end-of-life medication for adults who have been given 6 months to live. That's usually the guideline. New York, for its part, has started having that debate in the legislature, and Governor Cuomo said on this show in the spring that he supports it, but the votes weren't there this spring in Albany to pass it. They were there in Trenton, so this took effect last week. We thought that since this is now the law, we would go beyond the debate and bring on an advocate who was someone considering using the law herself, or at least wants to reserve that right for herself, which she now can, to explain some of how it works and to help with making this very difficult decision if you and a loved one might be considering it, and to understand the process now that it's actually a legal thing. So my guest for this is Susan Boyce, a patient advocate and volunteer with the group Compassion and Choices, which is a national advocacy group dedicated to expanding and improving end-of-life options and care. Susan, thanks so much for coming on with us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I'm really happy to be here.
And listeners, do you have a personal experience with this and want to share your story, maybe want to illuminate how this worked in your case if you have done this legally with a loved one in another state where it is legal, or maybe doctors who've participated in this want to call in and describe it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Any doctors from states that now have similar laws, or from New Jersey, maybe figuring out for yourself whether you even want to participate in this, or particularly if you do, if you are willing to say how it's going to work. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692, or anyone with a question for Susan Boyce. Susan, I want to start with a question about language. This bill is called the Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act, and I guess that's the contemporary framing, the words aid in dying. People used to talk about assisted suicide. They're different, right?
Yes, they are. The assisted suicide had the component that someone was actually helping the patient to end their life. In this case, this law provides for only the patient themselves to be able to self-administer the medication.
To self-administer the medication. How would one self-administer a medication that's going to end their life?
As far as I know, most people dissolve the medication in a small amount of liquid and they drink it.
Now, let me take a minute and tell a story, because one of the reasons we're doing this segment today is that a friend of mine named Steve made a point of making sure that I knew the New Jersey law passed and has now taken effect. We hadn't done a segment on the topic when the bill was being debated in Trenton, but my friend has been lobbying me to address it on the show for months and really wants people to know that this option is available in our region for the first time, because my friend's mother died early this year in California, which already had a law like this, and he sent me a few lines to read on the air if I chose to, and I will. So listeners and Susan, here are a few lines from my friend Steve telling his mother's story. Years before she was diagnosed with cancer and then ALS, my mother, Bunny North, made her 2 children and 2 grandchildren promised that she would never be kept alive if she was suffering and had no possibility of recovering from a final illness. After the ALS diagnosis, there were months of discussion before she began the complicated legal process last December to take advantage of California's end-of-life option law. In the 5 weeks it took to obtain the aid in dying medication, we had an end-of-life party for her. She received 80 emails extolling the remarkable life she had led. Several cousins flew in from New York to say goodbye, and she called every one of her closest friends and relatives for a final farewell. Visitors arrived until her last hours. She reminisced and sang songs with her grandchildren. She chose her favorite nightgown to wear. We each had a private conversation with her, and after a traditional prayer, we helped her drink the solution. She said, "I love you all," fell asleep, and died an hour later. And he writes, "It was exactly the peaceful, painless, quick death that she had wanted and that most of us hoped for." He writes, "I must be honest and say that for those of us with her, it was and remains a traumatic moment that we are still processing. But none of us have the slightest doubt that this was absolutely the right thing to do and that it should be available to anyone in that situation." So those lines from my friend. Does that sound familiar to you, Susan, regarding anyone you know in a state that has legalized this?
Yes, I think that that's a very familiar story for patients who've exercised this option. It allows the patient to have the time to say those important goodbyes and for people to come to terms with what's happening. And this law allows for is to cut out that last bit of, you know, suffering that people can undergo when they have a terminal illness.
I want to expand on one line in my friend's text there where he wrote, "I must be honest and say that for those of us with her, it was and remains a traumatic moment that we are still processing." And it did sound like it was, of course, profoundly sad and also kind of profoundly weird at these various points that he describes, like going to the doctor multiple times with his mom. This wasn't in the note, but he told me about this. And she was determined to ask for this as her brain was intact, but she had lost almost all bodily functions. And having an end-of-life party, as their family called it in that written note, it was traumatic and weird, even as the whole family came out of it as big advocates for this legal choice. How do you advise people to deal with the weirdness of that kind of conscious goodbye?
I'm not sure I'm in a good position to answer that question, as I haven't gone through this myself personally. But I think that when we have these experiences where we confront death, which is something very, very difficult, and I think our culture has made it hard for us to talk about our own deaths and to even think about them, I think that weirdness comes from the unfamiliarity with having had these experiences. But I don't think I think what it sounds like her end was a really loving and peaceful way to go. So I think it's going to be a balance in families between having to do some confronting of these very, very emotional times versus having a way to end the suffering.
We're talking about the Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act, which took effect in New Jersey on August 1st. And let's take a phone call. Judy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi there.
What do you want to add?
Well, I am the clinical director of End of Life Choices New York, and I work with terminally and incurably ill New Yorkers who are interested in being able to control the circumstances and timing of their death. Now I'm hearing calls from New Yorkers who are wanting to move to New Jersey or maybe have dual residency or are advocating for their loved ones who live in New Jersey who are eligible, as far as the law is concerned, for assistance. What I'm having to tell people is that it's so very difficult, particularly in these early days, to find physicians who will agree to help them, two physicians and some kind of a psychotherapist has to certify that the patient is decisionally capable and that they are indeed terminally ill. And it will, in time, there will be physicians who are able to identify themselves as resources, and there'll be volunteer groups that will help that process. But right now, it's enormously frustrating for people who've waited for such a long time, 7 years, I think, for the law to be passed, mm-hmm. and still not be able to find physicians that will help them.
Judy, can I ask you to elaborate on something that you just said there that's in the New Jersey law? A patient who wants an aid in dying drug needs to go to two different doctors plus get some kind of psychological evaluation to make sure that they're not just depressed. How does that work?
Well, as is the case in all of the other states that have legalized physician aid in dying, the challenge is to be very sure that this is a well-thought-out request that's based on a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, as determined by usually the treating physician. That needs to be confirmed by a second physician. They both have to agree that the patient is decisionally capable, so there has to be a second physician who has been able to examine this patient and agrees that they are decisionally capable and they are terminally ill. Now, in New Jersey, if there's any question about capacity, then that patient must also be seen by a psychotherapist, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, mm-hmm. Or somebody who's trained to do capacity assessments. I hope I'm correct about that. I've read through the requirements briefly, but I don't have them in front of me.
Mm-hmm. Susan, do you know if she got that basically right?
Yes, she did. That's correct.
And so, Judy, do the visits to the two MDs, you said the treating physician, so that's presumably somebody the patient would have already had an ongoing...
Ideally.
And then a second one. Do they need to be separated in time by a certain amount?
No, there's no time delay required, but I can tell you it sometimes takes a good deal of time to find a second physician. What you are required, though, is to wait for 15 days between the first verbal request and the second verbal request, plus there has to be a written request. So there's a deliberate waiting period that's a part of this process in all of the states, you know, Oregon, Washington, California, Vermont, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Judy, thank you so much. You added a lot. We really, really appreciate it. As we continue with Susan Boyce, a patient advocate volunteer with the group Compassion and Choices, a national advocacy group dedicated to expanding and improving end-of-life options and care, as we talk about the Medical Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act, which took effect in New Jersey on August 1st. Susan, would you tell a little bit of your own story, your medical condition, and how you became an advocate for this?
Sure, yeah. I have a rare genetic condition called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which has resulted in reducing my lung function down to a little below 30% of what a normal person has. I was first diagnosed 14 years ago. My first doctor said I had 5 years to live. Fortunately, he was wrong. I am now 56. I require oxygen to do most everything, but I still live a very good life. I have an amazing supportive family, and as my ability to do things decreases, I still find ways to contribute. Sometimes I find that people think that I'm eager to die, or that there's something about me that's compelling me to do this, and I'm not. I want to live as much as everybody else does. I have a very high quality of life right now, but I know when I get to the very, very end of this illness, for some people, it can be a very prolonged, drawn-out process, and that's the part at that very end when my quality of life falls below something that's unbearable. That's where I would like to be able to exercise this choice.
Emily in Hartford, you're on WNYC. Emily, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a nurse. I currently work in an ICU, and I just wanted to make a comment on the letter you just read on the air. Mm-hmm. It really brought tears to my eyes. So often we have patients who are so sick, and by the time they come in to see me in the ICU, you know, they're no longer able to make their wishes known or say what they would like, and it really falls to these patients' families and friends to, you know, make decisions sometimes about either continuing to allow that patient to live, but maybe in a way that they never would have wanted, but, you know, the patient can no longer indicate that, or, you know, make the decision to make them comfortable, allow a natural death. And I find that can be absolutely traumatic for families and for this, you know, bill that could pass and allow patients to have so much more dignity in when they die and how they go. And it could still be traumatic for families, but I think it makes such a big difference when they know that it's what their loved one wanted. And we can cause so much trauma at people's end of life. It's so nice to hear about people dying the way they want, with family around them, peacefully and with respect.
You raised yet another scenario just now that we haven't discussed, which is when the patient can't actually even anymore make that decision for themselves. Susan, let me ask you, are there circumstances under which somebody other than the patient has the legal agency to make that literally life and death decision?
No. So this is this bill, which has been modeled on the ones that went before, is a very narrow bill. It has to be the patient who makes that decision. It can't be a family member or loved one. Only the patient may make that decision, which means that there's a lot of patients who can get, you know, shut out of this. Obviously, people with dementia, oftentimes by the time they might want to exercise this, they no longer have the mental capacity to be able to make that decision. They wouldn't pass the mental health gate on the bill.
And Emily, thank you very much for your call. Brian in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. So I wanted to just raise, you know, and I think the last call I touched on this briefly, the use of morphine, you know, outside the context of this law and you know, I think is regularly used. I've had two family members die in the last decade or so. And in both cases, we got to a point where, you know, one had a so-called terminal wean, where morphine was used to comfort. And the fiction is that when life support is removed, the person will naturally expire. But the reality is the removal of life support is accompanied by so much morphine that that's, I believe, really what causes the, you know, the life to end. And then in another context, you know, an elderly person with a broken hip and, you know, doesn't, you know, not a candidate for surgery, and, you know, morphine started and then, you know, breathing becomes more labored and, you know, maybe a little fluid in the lungs, so the morphine is upped for increasing comfort. And it is anyone that works in that environment can predict, you know, how long it's going to take, 2, 3, 4 days. I mean, everyone sort of knew. And so I think that this happens already outside the context of this law. And I just wondered, you know, what your thoughts are on, you know, how this new law relates to what's currently being done and really, you know, not discussed, you know, politically, I think.
I'm glad you brought that up, Ryan. I'm sure that's on a lot of people's minds. I know that I've had at least one elderly relative who, when she was obviously dying from cancer, was given as much morphine as it took to keep her comfortable, and then probably a little more to help speed the dying process. Susan, I'm sure you've heard of this as a fairly common thing, kind of terminally ill patient aid in dying, a procedure under the table.
Yes, yes. And it brings up this point of hospice and how hospice dovetails along with this law. This law is not intended to replace hospice. Most people in the states where this has been legal for a while, most patients are already in hospice care when they choose to exercise this option. for many people, being in hospice and being cared with palliative drugs like morphine is enough. And for others, it may not be. And I think if we leave this decision up to the individual care providers as opposed to the patient, that's kind of where this is in my mind for me. Knowing that I would have the medication, that it's something that I could have control over, gives me a lot more dignity than to be at the mercy of someone who may or may not be charitable at the end.
Jeffrey in Rivervale has a question. Jefferson, right? Hi, Jefferson.
Hi, Brian. My question is about insurance in two ways. As you said, there were states that already have this. Does insurance cover this process? And also, do they cover the medication? And also, do they allow for people who do this to still receive, say, a life insurance policy or something like that? I asked the question because my own mother was ill for 7 years before she passed, and something like this being available at the time, and we live in New Jersey, what would be the, it would have been something that we may have chosen based on the quality of her life toward the end, which was really bad.
It's a good question. I know that some standard life insurance policies do include if you commit suicide, some don't. Do you know about that aspect, Susan?
Yes, I do. The life insurance under this bill, the cause of your death on your death certificate is what you were dying from and is not suicide. So life insurance policies will reflect whatever coverage you have based upon what you were dying from. So if it's cancer, that's what you're dying from, not suicide, because this isn't considered suicide. On the healthcare coverage, I don't know the answer to that one. But I do know that there had been concerns raised by people who felt like, let's imagine someone who has a very rare cancer and wants to pursue possibly life-saving, very expensive treatment, and a life insurance company, I mean, a health insurance provider might say, no, why don't you exercise this, right aid in dying instead? I know there's been a lot of fear brought up about that possible scenario, and we just haven't seen that happen in the other states. I mean, we have the advantage of having lots of data from states like Oregon, where this has been in effect for quite a long time, and so we can look at that data to see how this has evolved over time.
Can you talk more about what you've learned from the experience of the 9 states with aid in dying laws, California, Colorado, Maine, others, Oregon, as you state, was first, and that was way back in 1994, and I think they called it physician-assisted suicide at that time. Correct me if I'm wrong. So what has the experience from states that, or I should say, how has the experience from states that have had this for a while inform what went into this new New Jersey law?
Yeah, I think there's, our law is modeled exactly on their Oregon's law because it's been a very successful law. I think there's a few things that we've learned that people find a little surprising. One is that it's not very many patients that, we're talking about small numbers here, like thousands, not tens of thousands of patients every year, maybe 1,500 who apply for this right. And then there's not everybody takes the medication. For a subset of the people who apply, just knowing that they have that control at their disposal is brings them peace of mind. Another thing that's been an outgrowth, I think, that was a little unexpected from this law is that because of the role of the physician and having to have these conversations between the physician and the patient about what they want as an end of life for themselves, it's forced a higher quality dialogue between doctors and patients that has really changed. I mean, I think most doctors and most patients don't spend their time together discussing the patient's death. But because of the law and because of the education that goes along with this law for the physicians, the quality of those dialogues has improved, which has resulted in better patient care.
We're just about out of time. You mentioned the doctors. Doctors are split on this issue. Are they required under the law if they're treating somebody in this condition, terminally ill condition, to offer this? Of course, many doctors will say, well, the Hippocratic Oath means first do no harm, so I'm just not doing this.
Right, and there's absolutely no requirement that a doctor sign off on this if it goes against what they want to do. So it's up to the patient to find doctors who are supportive and are willing to do that. Now, as the one caller pointed out, in New Jersey, we've only had this in effect for 2 weeks, and so there is a ramp up period that we have to go through to bring these doctors on board and work out the mechanisms for how patients find those doctors. What that's happening right now, we have physicians from other states who have been involved in doing this in New Jersey, helping train physicians. So we've got that well underway. I'm not much of an expert on it, but I do know that's what's happening. And so it's going to take some time, but those mechanisms will be in place.
I was going to end here, but I'm going to take one more call because I see that we now have on the board a Philip in Virginia who says he's your brother. So I'm somewhere between oh how sweet and uh-oh. So Philip, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Thank you so much. And I assure you it's not an uh-oh. I did want to call to comment on the letter and the family reaction and add something I hope to be very simple. I think what Susan is doing and what our country is doing is recalibrating the way that we look at death. I have lived with a loved one who died, who I watched died. I myself have come extremely close to dying. And I am also a Buddhist. And one of the principles is fundamental to living is understanding and appreciating that you are going to die. It is a 100% certainty. This is not a surprise. And if we live in panic and fear about that, it does take away our quality of life and it takes away our dignity. And so as a family member, obviously, you know, this is a deeply, deeply sad event that would occur. But we need to give the person the right to decide when they can leave with a clear mind, not when they're being tortured and suffering with such, you know, agony. So to the person writing the letter, yes, you're going to need to recover from this. But and I don't know that they were saying that it was a bad thing. But ultimately, if there are family members who are insisting against it, I think that's selfish. And we all need to let go.
Susan, you want to say something to your bro here?
Thank you, Phil.
Philip, thank you. Thank you very much. And we will end there. My guest has been Susan Boyce, a patient advocate volunteer with Compassion and Choices, an advocacy group dedicated to expanding and improving end-of-life options and care. And I also want to thank my friend Steve North, a great journalist in his own right, for his contributions to this segment as New Jersey's Aid in Dying for the Terminally Ill Act has just taken effect on August 1st. Susan, thank you so much and good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Brian.